It's the UEFA Champions League on Paramount Plus. Europe's top club soccer tournament. Champions versus champions. The best teams facing off in the knockout rounds.
Magnificent!
And it all takes place
while you're filling out financial reports at work. In the middle of your day, in the middle of your week. So use that second screen. Call in sick. Do whatever you gotta do to tune in Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Nobody watches the UEFA Champions League like us. Stream every match live exclusively on Paramount Plus.
Streaming on Paramount Plus.
You ready, Bob?
Well, all right.
Audiences are raving. Bob Marley is electrifying. It's the feel-good movie of the year.
You dig?
Bob Marley, One Love. Rated PG-13. Now streaming on Paramount Plus.
Blitz is defined as a sudden, savage attack. It is indeed all this. The effect is sure. The premise is simple. It's a basic, primal confrontation. Man to man. No excuses are offered, none accepted.
Welcome to the latest edition of Longhorn Blitz with Horns247.com.
It's like a radio station.
Now, here are your hosts, lifetime Longhorn Rod Babers.
Pure athlete, yeah.
A transcend race, hombre.
Matt Butler.
I don't talk man. I back it up.
And we are chock full of that, man.
Damn right.
And Jeff Howe.
It's still real to me, damn it.
And that's the bottom line, because Stone Cold said so.
If you're gonna blitz, come strong, but don't come at all.
Coming strong with another edition of Longhorn Blitz with Horns 24/7. I am Jeff Howe. We've hit that kind of lull in the year-long college football calendar, but there's no lull here on Longhorn Blitz. We actually do have a lot to talk about, and we'll get into it right now. First off, wherever you're listening, however you're listening, we just thank you so much for being a part of another presentation of this podcast. Support this podcast by going to anywhere you get your podcasts. Search Horns 24/7, Horns 247, no dashes, slashes, or spaces. Click that follow button. Get every episode of The Blitz when it drops. And if you'd be so kind as to leave us a five-star review, we would greatly, greatly appreciate it. Let me bring in the rest of the team. He is the master of the soundboard, the drop machine extraordinaire, our lead research analyst on Longhorn Blitz, and a daily fantasy guru. He is Matt Butler. How are you, sir?
Doing pretty well, man. How about you?
Not too shabby. Can I tell you guys something, though? So I'll be 40 in September.
Big 4-0 going.
You guys notice, like, the older you get, it's almost like going through puberty again, where you start to get hair in spots where you never really dealt with hair issues before.
Trust me, it's unfortunate.
And my big one is nose hair right now.
Oh, like, oh man. And it's crazy. Like, it starts, and you're like, so why now?
Yeah.
I can't get hair to grow places I want the hair to grow, but places where I don't want the hair to grow, it's like robust.
No joke.
Amount of growth.
This morning on the drive in, right? On the drive in, I sneezed and then just kind of, I didn't have snot, but I just kind of rubbed my nose or wiped my nose like this. And I'm like, why is there's a hair follicle on my finger? Like,
oh, yeah. No, it's fortunate. Yeah. That's why they have ear, nose,
and throat.
All right, yeah.
Specialists.
Yeah, I'll start checking. I'm lucky. I'm like a hairless man.
So, a man who can tell you about ear, nose, and throat specialists or any number of topics you want to get into, he's a Renaissance man. He can do things like that. Wears many hats for the Austin Radio Network, including co-hosting Ball Don't Lie each and every weekday with Mike Harge from 3 to 7. But for the purposes of this podcast, he is our lockdown corner here on Longhorn Blitz. Lifetime Longhorn, 2002 UT All-American, 2002 semifinalist for the Jim Thorpe Award. Fourth-round draft choice of the New York Giants back in 2003. Spent his NFL career with the Giants, Lions, Bears, Bucks, Broncos, and a year with the Hamilton Tiger Cats of the CFL. When he was done with football, he got himself back to Austin, Texas and the 40 Acres, where he earned his degree. Whenever that T-ring comes back in, we will make sure he wears it proudly. Nevertheless, he is a card-carrying member of DBU. And when you get that All-American honor recognized by the NCAA, they make sure you get one of those black cards. Number 21 in your program. Number one in your hearts, Mr. Rod Babers.
I appreciate the intro, brother. Gets sweeter every time.
Rod, you realize we've been doing this show for over a decade now, and you are still the best number 21 to ever play football on the 40 Acres.
Hey, man, listen, I'm hoping one day. But you know what? It'll never happen because they change numbers too much.
True.
Very true.
Like, think about it. Jay Witts, like, he was 21 at one point, and then he's on his, like, third number or something. I don't know what the hell.
Worthy's on his third number in 3 years.
Yeah, like, guys, it used to be guys had a lot of pride in numbers. Like, even if you didn't really want that number, like, I didn't really want 21 to college level. I wanted number two. I wasn't going to get it because everybody wanted to be
Deuce. Dion.
Yeah, everybody wanted to do. So I got 21. But once you got 21, it's like, all right, let's make it famous.
Yeah.
Guys don't care about that anymore. It's like, nah, I'll just keep switching until I get a number that basically that number coincides with me being good.
Yeah.
And then once I'm good in that number, then maybe I'll keep that number. But Xavier Worthy, he said, and then there's like, if you have a down year, hey, I'm going to switch numbers because I don't want the bad number. That's from the slump year. Yeah. So I don't want that number. I'm going to switch to another number so I can get a clean slate. So the psychology of it is way crazy. And I just can't relate to it because I'm an old man now.
And for clarity's sake, to make the number 21 for football relevant, because I remember previous conversations with certain number 21s where they're like, hey, this number 21 at Texas is quite relevant.
Yeah. But on the gridiron, Rod is still.
Football field, of course. Yes. Yeah, I'm with you. I'm shocked by now. I thought by now.
We thought Duke Thomas had a chance. Jay Witt had a chance. Maybe Keaton Crawford has an All-American year.
At one point, Troy Meary, I think, had it.
Oh, yeah.
He first came out. He was wearing, like, when he had that, when everybody was talking about him at the freshman, as a freshman who was getting first-team reps in training camp.
Over Brandon Eagles.
He's wearing 21.
He was.
And I was like, all right, somebody's going to be. I am hoping and praying that there is a 21 greater than Rod B. Right now, there just ain't in terms of football.
Gideon was the only other one.
Gideon is very damn close, man. I mean, he's one of the DBU's all time greats, man. He's, in my opinion, I know people. What? That's crazy. It's like he started more games than any other player in history of DBU. You can't
count for some.
Yeah, what you got?
And he mentored.
That's hard to do.
He mentored Earl Thomas, and they were in the same like.
You talking about one of the heydays of Texas producing NFL talent? Nobody could take his spot. Y'all would have called a man a scrub? Come on, man.
Texas was still producing NFL DBs at that point.
Right?
Yeah.
That's a ton of them. And nobody could take his spot. And y'all would have
talked. Curtis Brown, Earl Thomas, Rod's favorite corner, Shockey Brown.
Started for 4 years, man. And could not slap that dude.
And according to Earl Thomas, Thomas's mentor.
Yeah. That's just because he's a white safety. And I know y'all don't like white safeties. I get it. Nobody, Cowboys fans, we have this discussion all the time. I hate white safeties. I get it, but. Man,
Hart should change his intro for your show because you don't like white condiments, but you love white DBs.
Well, because it's hard out there, man, for white DBs.
Yeah, 100%.
I get it, man. Trust me. As a black man, I understand when your discrimination as a white DB. You walk out there, people looking at you crazy like, you going with the DBs?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
You put the final nail in the coffin of the white corner, too.
I believe they're making a comeback. I believe now there's another one that was dressed. Somebody sent it to me.
Yeah, that
on
one
Twitter.
Guy for Washington 2 years ago, and so then some other guy.
It's coming back now. I mean, I'm pretty much done my part. I'm gonna leave it up to Westlake.
They were
Lake
dormant,
Travis to make
dormant
it happen.
For 20 years after you.
For a while, and I, you know what? Extinct. And I had a hand in that. And I didn't want to kill the last white rhino. It was a mistake. And it wasn't worth it, by the way.
Yeah,
he should have hit it for another corner, not for Rod B.
They even gave you Jason Sehorn's number.
They knew it. They was like, "Nah, this is the way we put we finally put the white corner."
Don't blame Rod. Blame Jim Fossil and Ernie Accorsi.
And with Gideon's career, it sort of was like emblematic of where we went societally. That like you're known from your one worst moment to where like it's like four great years, but dropping one interception against Tech in 08, and that's why he's defined his entire career.
And now he's back on the 48.
Well, that's literally what it is, though.
You're only right about that, Noah, because that was the biggest mistake in his career, if you will.
Or of that era of Texas football.
Era, whatever it is.
Even though we all know one play doesn't end a game, that one play is the one that's in the forefront of all minds until the Crabtree play.
Whenever someday when Ernie Accorsi goes into the Hall of Fame, which as an executive, he probably will go into the Hall of Fame. People are like, man, you got drafted John Elway and traded for Eli Manning and architect of Super Bowl teams. And we'll be like, nope, he and Rod Babers helped kill the white corner. That's Ernie Accorsi's legacy.
It wasn't me, man. I was not an accomplice. All right. I didn't know what I was in store for.
You were we'll call you an unwilling accomplice.
All right, unwilling then.
Unwilling.
Yeah, and unknowing.
Yes, exactly. You didn't ask for 30.
There's collateral damage.
But at any rate, this time of the year, I mentioned the lull, and you get to this time of year, and it's, you got coaches doing speaking tours, and you got conference meetings. I know SEC meetings are coming up at the end of the month in Destin, which, by the way, Texas fans, that's stuff you'll need to pay attention to, or SEC meetings. Cause
it's in Destin, Florida?
Destin, yes.
Oh, yeah. My wife took her bachelorette party there.
Redneck Riviera.
I think it's like a famous area.
It's a pretty place. I've been there once as a kid, only because like my parents were like, yeah, we're going to Florida to visit an uncle, but we got to stop in Destin because of their white beaches.
That's what apparently.
It's
Destin,
the only place on the Gulf.
Walton Beach. Yeah.
Somehow on the Gulf has all like your normal sand, except for in Destin, it has white that's sand. So like it's real pretty. Mm. It looks like a foreign place, and it's here in the middle of the Gulf.
It's nice. The beaches are fine.
You got it the red. Neck Riviera?
That's what they call it, yeah. Like, kind of area from like Fort Walton.
Sure, my wife did not know that.
Fort Walton Beach, Destin.
Yeah, the Florida, the place in Florida they call the Redneck
that
Riviera.
That might have changed her mind about.
Because Destin's not, for those that don't know, Destin's not in South Florida. It's kind of northwest part of Florida. So it's, yeah.
Okay.
It's a little bit different than it is in down
in
deep
the
South
panhandle.
Florida. Yes. Thank you, Matt. Oh. A little Florida geography update on Longhorn Blitz.
Oh.
But no, SEC meetings, because they're going to decide a schedule. Before we get into Sark, I just want to ask you guys this real quick. We won't spend too much time on this, but basically there's two scheduling models up for discussion for the SEC when Texas gets into the league and they go to 16 teams. It's either going to be the 1-7 model, which is one permanent opponent, and then you rotate seven opponents and at some point you'll play everybody,
yeah.
Or the 3-6 model where you have three permanent opponents and then you'll rotate the other six in a 9-game conference schedule. So one is an 8-game, one is a 9-game.
Yeah.
You guys have any preference one way or the other where the SEC goes? And I can tell you this, I haven't heard of any schools specifically that are staunchly for or staunchly against
one
or the other, with the exception of, and I've been told this by a pretty good source, that Texas, Oklahoma, Florida, and Georgia – very much favor a 9-game schedule because for them, they both have a neutral site game. Mm-hmm. So for them, it'd be 4 home, 4 road, 1 neutral site.
And Oklahoma, Texas, Oklahoma, it's your neutral site game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think from a fan perspective, I think I prefer the 9-game schedule.
Of course.
Conference. It just guarantees you games. One more big game instead of
the, whole point
the
of this,
SEC
right?
getting – the one thing the SEC is criticized of is getting the one throwaway game that they – throw in the middle while the rest of the country's playing conference games, because a lot of them have went to 9 conference game schedules, and it's what we've got used to here in the Big 12. They've always been 8, so makes me think that the SEC wants to keep maybe some of those teams that are more traditional, wants to keep their traditional 8, and then they get their throwaway to whoever they pay to come in. And, you know, those things do help those smaller schools, but we're in a time of college football that you don't necessarily have to have those big payouts. Everybody can make a good amount of money with all the TV and streaming.
Like, yeah. I looked at LSU, A&M's 2021 schedule, and sandwiched between a road game and a ranked Ole Miss and a season finale in Death Valley against LSU, you got a home game against Prairie View.
Exactly. And they all have those different ones. It's the game where Alabama's favored by 62. I forgot who it was this year or last year, but you see those in there. And Georgia will get one where they're up 55-0 on somebody at halftime.
And that'll be the most pissed off Nick Saban is all year, going into that game and coming out of it.
Because he knows his team is complacent at that time, and they're obviously looking past whoever that opponent is.
Then he's even madder at the media for overlooking the opponent in front of them that you're paying
a ton
of money.
Yeah, for talking about the next week's opponent.
Yeah, exactly.
All the time. Like, whoa, we got an opponent this week.
You can script it all to happen. You know how it's going to play out.
I think the whole point, well, at least for the fans and for the sake of the product, I thought the whole point was monopolizing all these big brands so that we can get these big brands facing each other as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to even get that even more so when the college football playoff hits.
Yeah.
Because now you're expanding the college football playoff. So, to me, it defeats the purpose. If you're going to bring in all the marquee blue blood brands of college football and college sports and essentially decide, no, we're still going to avoid playing each other. You know what I mean? Like, that's ridiculous.
I mean, you still, even if it's not a marquee brand, right? Like, if you're telling me for Texas, like, hey, you want to schedule Vanderbilt or you want to schedule Lamar? Of course I want to play Vanderbilt instead of Lamar.
Yeah. No, as I said, I don't understand. Like I said, it to me, and I know there are probably some arguments against the 9-game schedule, but as a fan, just coming from a fan perspective, that's the whole point. You want to monopolize college football, all right? So basically, you dominate the market share of college football. You're doing what Apple is doing with smartphone market. You're doing basically what great big corporations, like Google and stuff like that.
Coca-Cola, I just had a Coke Zero before the show started.
Coke Zero, right? What these big-time corporations do in terms of market share for whatever product or service that they are pitching. And SEC right now, they have monopolized the market share of college football. That's the whole point of it. And then, to me, why would you, water down the product by having them go play outside of the conference, at least keep it as to a minimum, and them playing outside the conference. Obviously, there are non-conference games. And even those now, we know they have a different significance too, where teams, even like Texas, are deciding, we don't want as many cupcakes in our non-con. That was even, you know, while the SEC thing or before it even happened, they were everybody was deciding to upgrade their non-conference schedule. I just think we're at a point now, people don't want the watered down, a different ecosystem of entertainment now. People do not want the watered down product of whatever you're throwing out there because we got options.
Yeah.
Yeah. You gonna give me that lackluster college football matchup? Okay. Well, that used to be sexy in 1987. All right, I'm changing the channel. Yeah. Sorry. And only the NFL is the only entertainment king right now that can put on any damn thing, any matchup, and get blockbuster.
That's why they can put a playoff game exclusively on Peacock and like,
exactly.
Y'all can complain about it, but y'all are gonna watch it. You're either gonna subscribe to Peacock or borrow someone's password or whatever.
They're America's number one television product. 80% of the 100 most watched television programs last year were NFL, and it'll be closer to 90 in 2022. They dominate television in this country, and they're the only ones that can do it. College football, I think, had like 4 or 5 of those games, so they're not even close.
Yep, and to show just a good example of when you have this 8-game schedule in the SEC and the way, like Jeff is mentioning, now when you add even more, you're going to have your common opponent, but then how rarely you sometimes meet up with certain teams. Texas A&M went to the SEC in 2012. They have played Georgia one time.
Yeah,
they still have not even had Georgia to College Station and play. And it's because, like, once you start playing the traditional teams, and especially the way that you have the East to West right now, and there's so many, and then you get basically a home and home, and after 2019, I don't know if they changed the schedule in 2020 and that's why they didn't play, or if it really is spaced out that much that you get
the first seven years to play in 2020 and it maybe got moved around.
I went through their schedule though, and it wasn't canceled because they played an all conference schedule that year and still didn't play A&M. So I'm thinking it was play all 7 from the East there and play all 7 from the East back. And they haven't came back yet, so that's talking 14 years. Yeah. So it won't be till like 2025 before you've gotten to play an SEC team at home. So if you're talking about adding 2 more teams to the situation and keeping it at 8, you'll literally have Texas possibly not playing an SEC team till 2040. You know, here in Austin, like you aren't
that's
guaranteed
ridiculous.
To get somebody from the other side. It's insane.
The SECs, yeah.
Crazy. So, that's why I think you need to have 9, because if you have 8, it really makes it scarce when you add to
down.
The numbers.
Yeah, it's a flawed formula.
You aren't even playing that conference team. It's like you play teams in your non-conference more. Like, Texas has played Alabama twice, you know, by the end of next year.
Wow.
It'll be crazy.
Yeah, it'll be crazy. Should have played LSU, too.
Yeah, Texas has played Georgia as much as A&M's played Georgia.
That's a great point. I agree.
Since they went to the SEC. That's crazy.
That is crazy.
So I think we're all on board with a 9-game SEC schedule. But that's at the end of the month, and Destin, we'll see what happens at the SEC meetings. All right, Rod, let's get into some of the Sark sound. Sark has been on the Texas Fight Tour. As we were sitting here recording this, the last stop is tonight in Houston. I'm going to be headed down there. As soon as we wrap up, I'm getting in the car and going. Rod, I know I got some audio from his stop in San Antonio and sent it out to the guys here at the Horn. And we've had, I've had some quick hitters here and there at Horns 24/7 and really working on getting that content out. You know, you got to space your content out because it's going to be a while before we hear from Sark.
Exactly.
But, Rod, you were saying the big thing that stood out to you was the cut, and I think this was the question I asked Sark about. It was about Quinn Ewers in reference to all the quarterbacks he's had. What's one thing they had in common in terms of where he sees the most progress quarterbacks in his offense going from year one to year two? This isn't Quinn's.
Oh, really? That was the question?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
the question wasn't in the audience.
This isn't Quinn specific. It's not Mac Jones or Carson Palmer specific. It is, you know, what does he see in common, and does he see those things in Quinn? And he said he did.
I didn't know. See, okay, that actually
context
puts it
matters.
Into a different. It really does. It puts a whole new kind of to me perspective on his actual comment. So I'm paraphrasing here, but essentially what he starts talking about and referencing. You let me know if I'm way off here because you obviously heard it too, Jeff. He starts talking about Quinn's ability to react and respond when the play breaks down.
Yes. Yeah.
he's basically referencing second reaction plays and his comfort level within the offense. But once the structure of the offense starts to deteriorate around you, which it inevitably will, that's football, right? Yeah. Receivers, sometimes they get jammed up. Sometimes they slip. So they don't want to run a route. Pass protection, you need all five, six guys involved to block perfectly. Yeah. That's all. That's a little tough, too, right? And at times, you know, something goes wrong. My man, Shano, there you go. Ding, ding, ding.
Mark that on your bingo card.
Your Shanahan reference. His famous quote is, be coachable, don't be a robot. And I think Sark is referencing in that cut about Quinn at times last year being a robot. And I know what it happened to Hudson Card in 2021 when we talked about it on the show. Hudson Card was being a robot. He basically was doing everything that coach told him to do. It's like, hey, because we basically the example, and like I said, this is just me trying to psychoanalyze Sark. We looked at the way Casey Thompson was playing the position, the way Hudson Carr was playing the position, both with similar conditions, circumstances with the same players. And when Casey was in there, learning a lot from Sam Ehlinger, who probably told him, dude, when that offensive line breaks down, you need to get the hell out of there. Because Sam Ehlinger scrambled more than any other quarterback in college football. A lot of that because the offensive line had some struggles, but also Sam liked to run. I mean, Bam Bam Sam, he's an athlete playing quarterback. He liked to run. That was kind of natural to him. And Casey, I think, kind of learned that lesson and took it to heart, even though I think they were being coached because Sark has often had, you know, very negative things to say about the possibility of having a running quarterback in his system and having essentially, you know, a design run plays for his quarterback. Like he always says, no, we don't major in that. You know, you don't mind it, we don't major in that. So he wants his quarterbacks to stay in the pocket, make NFL throws, and when they do scramble, he wants them to scramble to throw, not scramble to run. And Casey, I think, would listen to coach and go, yes, sir, and be like, man, I'm getting the first down. You can do whatever you want to do. And Casey would do that. Yeah. Hudson Card would listen to coach, yes, sir, that's exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going to scramble to throw. And it's like, well, yeah, but there's a first down right there. You can go get the first down. And, you know, there are other things you can do. You ain't got to scramble to throw all the time. And it made him indecisive and at times, you know, just made him make bad decisions on the football field. Then fast forward, right? He gets a year in the system. He feels a little bit more comfortable. And then last season, we watched Hudson Card be decisive when the structure of the offense deteriorated around them. Make good plays, whether it be the dump off or the check down or scrambling to get big yardage because nobody thought he was scrambling. Why? You watched last year's film. That's why. They were watching like, this dude ain't going to scramble. When he does, he's so damn late and indecisive. We'll just react to him, man. He ain't got no football instincts. Yeah. That's what you, and I agree. That's what I'll be watching too, but not in that offense last year. He was decisive, and I think a lot of it was his second reaction plays when he was off script. Now, keep in mind, this goes to Sark inevitably, right? Psychoanalyzing him. He is not comfortable off script. My biggest criticism of Sark, and I think most of us, is he is bad at the chess match within the game. That's probably his biggest issue as a coach. His preparation and game planning is probably some of the best in the country, which is why his scripts give him leads. But the football is played with four quarters of it, and usually your script only lasts about a quarter, if that. Yeah. All right? And then after that, it's all about adjustments. It's all about counters. It's all about you coaching on the fly, off script, second reaction coaching, baby. Mm-hmm. And Sark's uncomfortable with that. And for him to say now that he likes his quarterbacks doing that, that he needs that because that quarterback saves him.
Yeah.
Like, that's if that quarterback can have great second reaction plays and can be someone that can operate off script and off schedule, it helps Sark a little bit because Sark isn't great at that.
Yeah.
Right? That's something that you really cannot adjust to as a coach. You can try to, but it's really tough when you're trying to adjust to a guy who's just instinctual out there making plays instinct. That's not something I can, you know, watch film for, develop patterns and trends. You can't really do that. So I do, and I think Sark's going to get better at this. He's got to. If he doesn't, Texas won't win double-digit games, right, and they won't win the Big 12 or compete for it, and then Sark will be on the hot seat. But if he's got to get better at second reaction coaching, the chess match within the game, and being able to operate once your script is done, same thing with his quarterbacks. They asked the late, great Bill Walsh. This is from Jim Harbaugh, actually. He said he asked Bill Walsh. I spent time with Bill Walsh before he passed away during my first year at Stanford, and I asked him one day, what do you look for in a quarterback? And he said, athletic instincts. He said that quality is an instinctive, spontaneous, natural response to situations that develop in games. Walsh said some of his quarterback's greatness was that his spontaneous instincts would break loose between 10 to 15% of the time, often making a phenomenal difference in the result of the game.
Yeah.
That's the it quality. Like, I can't coach that. Yeah. All right? If you ain't got that, if you need every – think about it. Even at Alabama, when Sark's offense at its pinnacle, at its peak, right, the Mac Jones offense – Mac Jones only had to go to his second read less than 15% of the time, and that offense was operating on schedule, on script all the time. You didn't really have to have much second reaction plays. Here at Texas, it's going to be a little bit differently because you don't have the Bama roster at that time, too, and that was one of the greatest Bama rosters we've ever seen. You don't have those classes stocked, and you don't have Nick Saban. You don't have the GOAT behind you either. You're trying to do two jobs. You're trying to be the head coach and be the play calling offensive coordinator. So I think that to me, that was a deal. And hearing your question actually put it into even better context for me. That is a step in the right direction for Sark because I think, honestly, he's a little uncomfortable with his quarterbacks operating off script and off schedule second reaction plays, but he knows it's necessary. VY doesn't win that national title without the second reaction plays. Like, that's half of football, in my opinion. Yep. It really is. Like, that's half of football on both sides of the ball. Like, you get to coaching with the fundamentals and technique, but then, man, it's off schedule. Go be a damn athlete. Don't be a robot. Be coachable, but don't be a robot.
And that's why, like year ago when we first sort of heard that quote, we were like, you do realize that your best team at USC lost because of the off-script ability of a quarterback like Vince Young. And, you know, this sort of steers me three different ways while we're talking about this, because winning those plays, we always talk about plays that the defense wins, yet because of, say, a mobile quarterback or something along those lines, how the offense can still win. A way that it's, like, translatable in, like, the NBA playoffs is offensive rebounding. You can do everything that you want, but if you get the stop and you aren't able to box somebody out, a guy like PJ Tucker comes in and is able to get yourself an extra possession because they understand the intricacies of, you can do all those things that make you great, but then whenever I put myself in this position after the defense has won, our team can still win in certain scenarios. And that's why, like, offensive rebounding is so big with the Miami Heat. And you see players with that high IQ that you're talking about and being able to go off script and just naturally read things while they're in there or while they're in play. And that's what sort of brings me back to talking about Quinn, because there were times last year where we did see this. Two plays that stand out to the forefront of my mind is, like, the most impressive pirouetting catch Bijan made against Oklahoma, when you heard post game in the Oklahoma game and heard Bijan talking about it, they talk as if, like, there was this full minute of communication. All it was Quinn giving a look to Bijan, like, I'm in trouble, you need to get open. And I'm quoting Bijan, and Bijan's like, yeah, Quinn looked at me like, hey, you got to get open, bro. And Bijan knew it's time for me to break off what I'm doing to take off downfield, and Quinn threw him open. And they talk as if, like, there was this in-depth communication, and all it was one look in one split second, and they both understood what needed to be done, and that play moved the chains. And it reminded me of another one where the very first game of the year, where a guy that, you know, coming into game one, there was no pre-existing relationship with Quinn on anybody on the team except for with Jatavion Sanders. And there's a play when one of first of Jatavion Sanders down the right sideline, when he gets all of his yak, is because he's blocking, and he's just breaking off a block and realizes Quinn's in trouble. And instead of doing his job, which is supposed to block, he just sort of leaks out to the side. Yep. And Quinn is able to off script just make a quick flip and play something that's totally unscripted. But those are, like, basically, there was the Alabama base. So we're talking about in two of the first three games that Quinn played on campus, he already was forming that chemistry with a guy like Bijan. Bijan's another level talent. But, like, you could see that those type of off-script ability is inside there. Yep. But also, when you're being coached to do what you need to do and do it within the framework of the offense, maybe that freedom wasn't necessarily always there because Quinn's trying to get the job done. So just those two being at the forefront of my mind make me think that, especially if, you know, Sark's sort of empowering the playmaker inside him, be like, hey, no, run the play. But understand, if that play's going to hell, you make a play because you're a transcendent talent. You can make a sidearm throw like a shortstop that's barehanding the ball and has to change his arm angle and make us a play because we got to move the chains, and that's good if we see that.
Great examples, too. I remember both of those.
Rod, within a 10-minute drive, there's probably, what, 6-7 high schools around from where we're sitting right now?
Oh, yeah.
Go out to any one of those fields in spring practice, and what we're talking about, it is kind of abstract, and it is a kind of higher level thinking, but at a certain level, it's very rudimentary too, because go out to any of those high school fields, and what are you going to hear high school coaches tell their guys? Don't think, react. Don't think, react. Because when you start thinking, you're already a step behind. It's basically what football comes down to. It's not thinking, it's reacting. And to what Bill Walsh was talking about with the athletic instincts, I love that, because you know, it's not all just being about Vince Young or Johnny Manziel and how widely can you extend this play. Sometimes it's extending it with your eyes. It's having the arm talent to extend it. It's being able to anticipate. And that's one of the things Sark talked about in that cut when I asked him. He said, you know, sometimes it's, hey, your first read's not always going to be there. How are you going to process and get to your second read? And sometimes you might have to go to your third. And sometimes there might be times where you have to go to your fourth read.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not going to be perfect for you all the time.
That's the whole point. That's why, going back to the Shannon quote, that's what he's basically saying. He said, you know, be coachable. Don't be a robot. I'm going to provide you with what I believe are going to be the different situations that you're going to be presented with defensively, how they're going to attack you, how they're going to try to exploit you. But I'm not perfect. I'm not Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm going to be wrong. I mean, and you're going to come back here sometime and go, Coach, you was wrong. I'm like, yeah, all right. Okay, now come back here. Now we'll adjust. Yeah, I mean, nobody there, right, is without, you know, being fallible in a situation. And that's the key to football, right? You have to be able to adjust on the fly. And that's why he's saying, listen, I'll provide you with the coverage I think they're going to get, and you'll have options within the offense and, you know, within the design of the offense. But once that design breaks down, you need to know the offense well enough to know it's where it's starting to deteriorate.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And what that opens up for you. All right. Whether it's my first read's taken away because, man, he's over there playing bump and run, and that's a really good bump and run corner who's great at the line of scrimmage, and he's probably going to jam that guy up. You got to already know that. And if that's where the play breaks down, you should have anticipated that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, yeah, I already knew that was going, but I went early to my number two. As Matt mentioned, I kind of gave that look. I always do a spring ball, and he like, mm-hmm. oh, man, he must be coming to me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then you can do that. Or, hey, man, I got to, like you just brought up, I got to manipulate the safety with my eyes. Coach didn't tell me to do that, but this safety's been cheating on me all day, and he's been trying to get to that curl route. Okay, mm-hmm. if I can just cheat like I'm going to that curl, I definitely going to open up that back door post route. I definitely can hit it, but I got to move it with my eyes. I got to over-exaggerate these. It's like it's those types of mm-hmm. things. And that's on you being a player, knowing knowing the offense well enough, but also knowing your teammates well enough. That goes to the chemistry that mm-hmm. Matt brought up. And also just the athletic instincts that we just referenced with Bill Walsh, man. And some guys don't have it. It's okay.
Yeah.
It really is. Some guys just don't have it. But Hudson Carr just showed us last year, you can get better at it.
Yep.
You can improve that area of your game. You just had to tap. You got to know how to tap into it. It's in you. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how you made it to this level.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have it. Charles Barkley always says, "I mean, anybody in the NBA can score. That's how they got here."
Yep.
Like, you know what I mean? You just got to be able to learn how to tap into it. And I think that's what he's talking about with Quinn. And that's a huge step, man, for Sark. He's uncomfortable having, in my opinion, this conversation because, like you said, it is nuanced.
Yeah.
And we're talking about something very abstract. I was watching Sauce Gardner because I'm obsessed with Sauce
Gardner.
He's insane. He's unbelievable. I mean, the first rookie to be an All-Pro since Ronnie Lott in the secondary. Just unbelievable. He's just a freak. And he brought up a term that, man, it sits with me because I remember Coach Akina talking about it. And he didn't talk about it until we were veterans. He said, I don't even like to bring this up with young players because they don't really understand. They kind of overemphasize it, and they don't understand the subtlety of it. And he said, body language. He was like, body language doesn't whisper, it screams. And you realize the older, I see, the more of a veteran player you get and more experience you get in football, you do realize that body language starts to speak to you mm-hmm. more and more. If you don't have a lot of experience, it doesn't talk to you at all. It's almost like that was Charlie Brown cartoon. That's like, nom, 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 nom. But as you get experience, your body language tells you everything. The way a guy leans, you know what I mean? Like how they come out of their breaks, you know, how they get into their breaks. Hell, sometimes it's their shoulder. Sometimes it's their arm. Sometimes it's their stance. Like, body language is. And he's like, man, he was just talking to me. He's like, man, it's so weird. I talk to some people about it and they don't get it. And I talk to some people and they go, yes. I get it because they understand it. And he said, I've been reading body language probably for my entire career. And he said, I've really gotten good at it. It's almost like people get good at, you know, lip reading or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a skill. And I think for anybody in football, it's really important. Not for quarterbacks, maybe not as much. But just getting back to, there are some very abstract, nuanced things to discuss in football that aren't necessarily concrete, concrete technique, concrete foundational coverage, this route concept, this. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of concrete black and white things in football,
yeah.
but there's a lot of gray too. And it's a beautiful gray if you kind of understand it and can tap into it and take advantage of it, body language being one of them,
yeah.
the athletic instincts being another one. But if you cannot tap into it, that gray can almost be a fog. And you'd be like, what, where the hell am I?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And So I think that's what we're discussing here, and that's why Sark's a little uncomfortable with that. He was all, he's like kind of a black and white guy. I wanted this, I wanted that way. Yeah. And we're talking about the gray areas of it, brother, the gray areas of football. And I love the gray areas because that's to me, if you're going to be an all-time great players, they always tap into the gray area. They find they find power in that abstract, nuanced area. Yeah. They extract from it. A lot of players stay away from it. They want to just keep the black and white and the concrete stuff. The evaluation of the quarterback position and development of it, it's all gray area.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and then, black and white about it.
And then interpreting and being able, like, not a, I like the body language thing because, like, when us from the outside, because us can't see himself, but he looks so loose and fluid when he's playing. Like, you can see the type of confidence. Like, him with sticking with Tyreek Hill as if he's his shadow, it's just crazy watching that dude. But when it's literally like he's a shadow on a person, just how close, and he never touches them.
Because he's reading body language, which most people, I don't understand. I understand some of that language, but I can't speak it all. It's like Spanglish. I get a little bit of it, but I can't speak it fluently.
Right before that, it reminded me of just like being able to, but the ability to be able to read and identify defenses, like, you know, so if we're talking about quarterback and receiver relationships, and it sort of reminded me of thinking back, you know, and we always talk about the Colt and Shipley in 8-1, but like some of the best stories I remember hearing about Colt was him talking about, like, say Ohio State, the play against Quan, but they had recognized that coverage earlier in the game, and, you know, at that point immediately Quan told Colt, hey, if they are doing this, we're going to go right back, and I'm running that slant inside of him, and just watch for that all game. But it's something that's that quick and real easy that, okay, it didn't work here, but I know I've seen this. It's a flashbulb in my mind. If you get that flashbulb pre-snap, Colt, look at me, and we're going to do it. Same thing that he did with Marquise Goodwin. Colt went to him right after that the next season in 09 in the OU game and was able to hit a slant to win and beat them. But it's all those different things that player and, you know, you can have the call, the play called from the coach, and you can have everything with the framework. But like you always talked about, right? Like, oh, Coach Aquina gave you all that freedom on the field that – you're the ones out there. I'm not out there. If you see something and you are strong about what is going to happen, you are making the plays, make the play. And that even works on offense, that a coach isn't going to be mad at you if you've done your homework, you're reading what you're facing, and you do something that's going to be able to make the team be more successful. And that's just a level of maturity that shows that the players are on the same page and they're reading the right things and being able to identify their opponents in live time, which is the one thing coaches can't do because they don't have that point of view.
It's like that Charles Amena who play against Tech, stopping the quarterback sneak. He's like,
I don't care.
I watch film, and 99% of the time in this situation with this formation, they run quarterback.
When they get under center in short yardage, it's always Chris Nelson.
I'm going. I already know what they're doing. It's like, no coach.
That's what you need.
It really is. And if he was wrong, I guess he's wrong, but. Yeah, I would have loved to have that type of conviction because I, like I said, my story was always the Texas Tech game, and I probably should have done it too. I mean, there are times when in games where, hell, man, that athletic instinct, it takes over.
The we talked about last year, the interception that Jalen Ford had in the Kansas game. Because he said it wasn't anything that they were coached to do. He said he and DeMarvian Overshown just had that relationship. He said, hey, if the
quarterback,
and Demo said, if the quarterback breaks contain, I'm going to go to the quarterback. You fill my spot in the zone. Just peel off your man and fill my spot. Because they figured, look, whether it's the backside safety or the play side safety, the nickel, somebody's going to be responsible for that area Jalen Ford had. Mm-hmm. And the risk of giving up a 6-yard pass, that's not what we're worried about. It's the reward of, man, it's either a sack or a tip ball or a pick or something. That risk is well worth giving up maybe a 6-yard completion.
Risk reward. Yeah, no, that was a beautiful – that's a good point. I forgot about that play. Yeah. That's a great play.
Yeah.
Great play.
So that's the kind of stuff we're talking about. The other thing, too, and then we always use the classic Mike Leach example that his quarterbacks have talked about, where early in their careers, he'll give them a situation where, hey, you have a play call – you've got the freedom to audible, and you don't check to the runs. Why didn't you check to the run? Well, because we had a pass play called. No, dummy, check to the run. There's three guys in a box. Exactly. Check to a run.
He's like, I'm Mike Leach. I'm going to call a pass play every time, but there's a check to a run for you to go to if you see it, you're the guy out there.
Well, the quarterback
identifies
his checks and balances.
Yes.
Yeah, I'll call a pass play,
but that's empowering.
You are literally my checks, but you're the checks and balances of the offense. You have eyes on the field.
Which was a foreign
and that's
thing
why,
for most
back
football.
To Sark, that's why it's important. And Quinn can be the checks and balances of Sark a little bit, right? Because Sark, like I said, as a play caller, Sark's got some tendencies that lend him to be more like Coach Steven at times than Coach Sark, who the one who we all love and adore. And I think for Quinn out there with, you know, because I think there are a lot of routes, and just when I went back and watched them, kind of just like primary read routes for Sark in his offense, mm-hmm. which is why we've seen those force feeding X-Men mm-hmm. a lot. Yeah. And I think another little bit of that is, I don't know if I you know, some of it is I want to get the ball to X-Men. I want to force feed it to him. But I think also some of it is I want to simplify it for my quarterback and make it easy. And cut and dry, black and white, it'll be open. Sometimes it was wide open. Yeah. And the guy dropped it or Quinn missed it. So I'm not saying Sark is wrong about that. But I do think now you'll get more RPOs in the offense mm-hmm. this year. RPOs are about hand manipulation, and it's about mesh points, and you got to really trust the read of the quarterback, what they're seeing. Y'all got to be seeing the same thing. Everybody on the offense needs to be seeing the same thing. And I think he'll have more of them in this year because he trusts that quarterback. And I also think you'll lose a lot of those kind of force-fed, you know, that primary read mm-hmm. Designated targets in his offense, too, that we saw early on. And he won't force it. He'll just allow a confident Quinn Ewers, a veteran Quinn Ewers, to go through the actual progressions in the offense.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also when you start to face some of, say, the top half of the, you know, schedule's defenses, not your weaker defenses, but sometimes it ends up getting to a point where, well, they're going to take away your primary guy. And we saw a lot of times last year whenever it becomes the fifth skill guy mm-hmm. is going to be left wide open, the way we saw Kasey Kahne at times throughout the season, or whoever the fifth guy is going to be. If you'll see it all the time in the NBA, like they lock everybody down into the shot clock. It comes down to being your P.J. Tucker has to make a shot, your Gary Payton the second, or who was Andre Iguodala on those Warrior teams for so many years. Mm-hmm. And it comes down to who is your worst skill guy to make a shot. Well, same thing with football. Texas has finally got to the point, I think, this year where their worst guy is going to be better than the opponents that they're facing. Like, it can be A.D. Mitchell, or it can be somebody like, if you get a healthy Nayor, and if Texas can get back to that point where that person isn't, and it's no disrespect to Kasey Kahne. He was just put into a position that was maybe one that he wasn't necessarily in the best spot for. And now if you can get your skill level up to the point that then when the defense wins everything and it comes down to being you have to go to your last option, our last option is still better than that defender.
I think, too, the other thing that I want to make sure we don't miss this point on this topic. I'm talking about the positive plays you make. It also helps you prevent mistakes and potentially catastrophic mistakes from happening if you're able to understand the offense. Mm-hmm. You know, Rod, the offensive coordinator on the 40 acres when you were there, and for a long time, Greg Davis. I remember Major Applewhite. I heard other quarterbacks that played for Greg Davis talk about his deal was reserve the right to punt. Look, our defense and special teams, some of the best in the country. A punt's not a bad thing. We'll punt. Defense will get a stop. Special teams flip the field, and we'll be right back in business. Agreed. Just don't turn the ball over. And Sark, you know, he was on Light the Tower with Craig and I right before the spring game, and I've never heard him say this, but I think it's the best quote of what he tells his quarterbacks in terms of their decision-making when things go wrong. Don't turn a fender bender into a fatality. If it's going to be a bad play,
I like that.
Sometimes you just got to throw it away or whatever.
Yep.
Don't try to force a ball into coverage or scramble around and take a sack and lose yards. At that point, you're turning the fender bender into a fatality.
Yeah, just hit the car in front of you. Don't peel over and roll off the road.
Yeah, and like I said, it's some of those kind of predetermined throws, basically, that Sark had to force feed to football to X-Men. Some of them were wide open because Sark, he literally dialed them up, right? That was, he saw the right, he knew the right covers they were going to play. He kind of baited the defensive coordinator into it mm-hmm. based on some of the previous plays out there. So we know Sark, he's got to have that deep ball, baby. He's like, Pookie, I got to have that deep ball. And like I said, and sometimes it is perfectly dialed up and it's just a drop or obviously an over throw or a miss throw or whatever. But getting back to the point you made, I do think, you know, some of those, especially like the Oklahoma State game, I mean, you were just throwing it into coverage. That could have easily been picked off by some savvier defensive bats, and it was on some of those against TCU.
Hodges Tomlinson got up against TCU.
So I think you'll have fewer of those predetermined throws because he's going to trust his quarterback to be able to go through progressions within the offense and actually operate the offense. And I go, all right, predetermined throw. You know where you're going with the football, right? All right, you ain't got to read a damn thing. You know where you're going. Now, because remember last year, that was the big thing with Quinn, right? If you could give him into a man against man coverage, he was amazing. Mm-hmm. But when he had to throw and have to actually diagnose a pre-snap disguise and then be able to match up the pre-snap diagnosis with the post-snap diagnosis, it didn't always track, didn't line up. And when it doesn't line up, that's when quarterbacks hold the ball, and that's when they're indecisive. And that's when we saw Quinn a lot of the times last year when teams were throwing at some exotic pre-snap looks at him and just playing of the zones, which is why the three high safety thing, you know, teams gave Texas a little bit of trouble with that. So I think now that he's seen more of those coverages, it won't be so bizarre to him, so exotic to him, and you can trust him now to go through progressions and be decisive with the football and not have, like I said, the predetermined throws. You still have some of them, but not so many of them where it's like, well, why the hell are we doing that when the other guy was wide open? It's like, well, because it was a predetermined throw. He Sark won't admit that, but just based on what I'm looking at.
I think the other thing, too, for a guy like Quinn, and Sark, I think, realizes, look, Sark's been around first-round picks and Heisman winners, and he's coached in the NFL. He coached a guy that was a league MVP in Matt Ryan. Sark knows what elite quarterback play looks like, and I think he's got to feel at this point like Quinn legitimately has a chance to have a long future playing this game. Mm-hmm. And at some point, it's like it's the thing that I talk about that brings down guys. It's the difference between a couple of wide receivers I can compare. Like, it's the difference between, like, Larry Fitzgerald and Dez Bryant to me. At some point, your physical skills will deteriorate.
Yep.
Unless you're LeBron James and you're just a freak, your physical skills at some point are going to taper off.
But your
some guys can do it for a long time, but at some point it's going to taper off. Yep. At some point for LeBron, it's going to taper off. But getting back to football, when Dez Bryant's physical skills tapered off, he was done.
He was.
But he didn't.
He was done.
And Fitzgerald was able to sustain his career over time because mentally he adapted to the game and understood the game, what he was going against, so he could still
I think DeAndre Hopkins is doing the same thing right now.
Yeah, I agree with that. And LeBron's doing the same thing, too, which is going to make him last so much longer.
Well, when your physical skills deteriorate, what do you fall back on? And it's developing and honing and harnessing that second nature ability to understand what's going on around
That's why Tom Brady lasted forever, because he never even had necessarily those physical skills.
Look, man, at some point, if Quinn's fortunate enough to play in the NFL for double-digit years, at some point he's going to try to throw that deep comeback, and it ain't going to have the same kind of zip it had on it.
Mm-hmm. No.
5-6 years earlier.
I mean, just look at the career arc of Mahomes and, you know, going from the not necessarily struggles of 2020, but just having to adapt to the way defenses defended him and how he was able to really to change coverages in the NFL for a good couple years. But then it even took time for him to mentally adjust. And that type of back and forth is going to happen over time, and it's going to happen over and over and over, to where you always got to be able to have that mental side trying to keep that edge that can keep your physical skills out there, because there's going to be somebody that comes in that has a cannon arm like you at some point. You can separate yourself mentally.
Other than, you know, Brady, Peyton Manning might be the best example. Like, Peyton Manning, the mental side of Peyton Manning's game lasted a lot longer than the physical. We'd already seen the physical stuff drop off, but the mental side with him was so good that he got what, an extra probably 3 or 4 years.
Same with Drew Brees. Mm-hmm. His arm strength was shot by the end of it.
Yeah.
No, I think it's like I said, it's for Sark to acknowledge it. A guy who, you know, we dive deep into audio and sound of Sark. He kind of stays away from the comments about second reaction and guys operating off script. I think he understands now, I actually need one of those guys because that's my failsafe within the offense. And his offense is, you know, it's an amazing offense. It's prolific. But, you know, every offense, depending on the right coverage and great players winning their share of battles up front one-on-ones, I mean, any offense can be stymied. You can be disrupted. And I think he's kind of looked at where the offense was disrupted last year and probably went, man, I need my quarterback to go out there and just make some more plays.
Yeah. And you aren't always going to run good. You're going to have things that hit the thing. You can be as good as you want. It's not going to run optimal for you. And when that doesn't happen, you have to be able to, in the moment, adjust and rely on your instincts.
Well, that's the problem, too, going back kind of with the running game, is the running game, that's what Bijan and Rojo were great at, actually. Mm-hmm. They forced more missed tackles than any running back duo in the country, and actually were two of the best in the last 5-6 years in all of college football.
Tandem, arguably, ever.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, you could throw those numbers in there with any tandem that in the Pro Football Focus era, or probably since they started keeping
North
track
Carolina
of it.
North Carolina with Javonte.
But that's my concern about the running game, is that, hey man, the running game might not be on track either, because the running game wasn't operating on script and on schedule. you had two guys that when you have a negative play or a potential loss, they would turn it into a gain. And when you lost those two guys and then you had to play a football game versus Washington, good defensive front, by the way. Washington had a really good defensive front, too. Got to throw that out there.
Better than I thought.
Yeah. It was a good defensive front. But your running game was a non-factor. And that's because your running game without the training wheels of Rojo and Bijan, that's how it actually looked. That's the actual running game without this, the extraordinary talent of Rojo and Bijan, your best player and your best leader. So a lot of work to be done there. And I think Sark understands, man, while we work on this run game, I need the pass game to be prolific to the point where the run game's going to work because they ain't going to put nobody in the box because they dropping everybody back.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing that I wanted to talk about real quick, well, we got a couple of minutes from those cuts that we heard from Sark again. We'll talk about some of this if anything new pops up tonight. We'll talk about it next week. But he was asked about Trill Carter and, you know, what he brings to the table. And Sark talked about wanting experience. But, Rod, I think it's Sark – we talk about the need to improve the run game, and maybe you've got to kind of take the reins off of Quinn a little bit and let him be an athlete. I don't think Sark or PK wants to lose. They realize they can't take a big step back with their run defense. I'm going to run down how good their run defense was last year.
It's amazing.
You just using Football Outsiders. Yeah. Line yards per carry allowed, 26th in the country. Mm-hmm. Standard down line yards allowed, 27th in the country. Passing down line yards allowed, 29th in the country. Opportunity rate allowed, and Matt, you can expand on this, 11th in the country. Mm-hmm. Now, here's where it gets kind of wonky. Power success rate allowed, 65th. Stuff rate allowed, 102nd. If you could get Texas to third and short or fourth and short, you could have some success. The problem was getting there.
Yep.
You didn't get there very often.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point, too. And, man, that's those numbers kind of mind-blowing. And I'm with you. I think they realize the secret to their kind of defensive philosophy is, all right, guys, we got to stop the run first. And then it makes everything easier for us. There's a positive kind of domino effect when we just stop the run. Like you said, specifically on early downs, because they're not stopping the run, as you just mentioned, necessarily really well on those short yardage situations late in the downs on third and short and fourth and short. And I guess we saw that early against Texas Tech. I mean, they got some of those shorts and conversions, too. So it's – yeah, I mean, it's to me, I think that's where their form is. And they know they lost Keandre Coburn and Ojemo, and they can't quantify what the impact's going to be just yet. You don't know.
Yeah.
You think you do, but remember, we went on how they platooned that group last season, and, man, that was probably not only did they have the depth, one of the deepest interior D-lines in the country, but, man, I think the rotation was a really effective one, too, where it kept those guys hungry, but also allowed them to be really, really fresh. So this year you just won't have that type of ability. Now bringing in Trill, that's part of it, so you could add to it. But, I mean, just losing Ojemo and losing Keandre Coburn and just adding Trill, I still don't think it's going to be able to supplement what you lost or compensate for what you lost.
Yep, and basically when you talk about the disparity between stuff and opportunity rate, with opportunity rate, like Rod was sort of mentioning, it's on those early downs that you just basically were able to get them off schedule. You kept them under the 4 yards that's needed, you know, to stay on schedule, quote-unquote, for an offense. You're able to go and get yourself into maybe passing down situations, which is good because Texas caused a lot of pressures and was able to do well in that. But when you look at fully the other way, stuff rate is zero or negative yards. So it doesn't necessarily, it's still a win if you're only giving up one or two, but on fourth and one, fourth and two, you know, sometimes that's going to keep the chains going. You just weren't necessarily getting negative plays, which is something that's hard to demand for, but it's also how you can truly find an elite defense.
Yeah. So you got to think the advantages with the offense because they know the snap count on a short yardage situation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're maybe a half a beat behind. You can't, you can't come out. You just fire out of the blocks. Your ball get off. Not to say it's going to be bad, but it just might be a half step slower than it. Yeah, it might be a half step slower or one, you know, that split second less reactive than it needs to be.
And
all of a sudden, they got a new set of downs.
When you look at stuff rate, Texas at 102 was 15% of plays, 15.1% to be exact.
Okay.
Oklahoma State was number two in the country, They were at 25.6. So we're still talking about, 10% difference is significant, but we're still talking one out of four plays you're able to get negative for Oklahoma State, one out of six for Texas. So, there is a significant difference, but it still isn't as huge as, say, looking at number two and 102, which makes it look way, way worse.
Okay.
Yeah, if you look at – I'm just looking at just raw numbers right now. I mean, Texas was a top 35 run defense last season. And then you go to yards per carry allowed. Hold on.
That aligns with what we're talking about, too, with the opportunity rate. Because over time, Texas was usually keeping a team off schedule. It's just in this very dire situations when you need to stop on fourth and one. We weren't necessarily good at making teams get 0 or 1 yards in context to the rest of college football.
Yeah, 3.48 yards per carry. Basically, 3.5 yards per carry is what Texas allowed last year. But you got to think, you go back to 2021, they were over 5.
That's crazy.
Allowing over 5 per carry.
It was one of the worst rush defenses in the history. 5.2,
I think,
of the school. It was, like I said, this is one of the greatest turnarounds in the history of Texas football. No question. Oh, yeah, defensive turnarounds.
Yeah, never in 1 year for sure.
But like, it's unbelievable.
Maybe, I'm sure Texas fans somewhere thought of this. Maybe PK's just going the opposite way the previous coordinators have, where you have a hot start.
That'd be great.
And then it just burns down in flames. Maybe
it takes patience, but it's not good for the modern immediate society.
Got engulfed in the flames, and now he's coming out of it.
That'd be amazing. but my concern would be GP no longer being there. I know he still probably can call GP and hit him up, but GP was working hard in the building. So you don't have GP. And then the concern about being able to tie and coordinate the pressure packages and the fronts with the coverages, because I think GP came in and kind of helped what was lost in translation and whatever reason there was a disconnect there. And I believe he made the connection. No, maybe the connection is made and they don't need him anymore, but that would be my concern. And, DeMarvion Overshown, and Ojimo and Coburn, leadership is my question.
Yeah.
They lost a lot of leadership. Not talent. I think they can. I think they will be able to. I'm not saying replace the talent, but they got talent, unproven commodities. They're ready to go. They do.
The talent shouldn't drop off that much.
You should be ascending now in terms of talent development and the NFL caliber players you're putting out. That group last draft should be the beginning.
Yeah,
that's the start of it, and then you're supposed to be having other guys that are able to step up in those situations. So I'm not worried about the talent drop off. I'm worried about the lack of leadership, though. I mean, you lost a ton. You lost a ton. You lost your best leader in Rojo. I mean, when the team lost at Tech, it was Rojo that called the damn meeting.
Yeah.
I mean, that he was the guy.
And Sark has even said that this offseason. He's like, no, he was like the heart and soul of our team.
Yeah, it was him.
Yeah.
He ended up doing some stuff like that with the Bears. Richard Hightower told a story that they had a meeting that, everybody was in the meeting, special teams. And then after the meeting was over, he came back in the special teams room, and this dude was picking up trash that everybody had left in the meeting room.
Water bottle.
Just because he wants things done a certain way. Like, things need to be done a certain way, and they always need to be done the right way. That's the way I like to do things.
Yeah.
And that guy, you lost. So, okay. Bijan is, there's just a presence about Bijan, right? And a presence about Rojo. And they're raving about Rojo right now with the Bears and talking about, how mature he is and that they want him to be a Bear for a long time. And then on the defense side, Coburn had been there forever. I mean, he was old school. He was OG. We know Ojimo was a leader. Hell, he got in trouble for it. Almost got silenced for it because he couldn't keep his mouth shut because he was so damn passionate about what was going on. And he wanted to make sure that he got rectified and he wanted to lead the program better than he found it. He's one of those guys that came here to play for Texas, not coming to play at Texas. And that's why coach was like, no, he going to play. But we did let him know, like, hey, man, don't be telling the family business. We know we got some issues, but we going to get it fixed. You lost that leader. You lost DeMarvion Overshown.
Even Anthony Cook been there for a long time.
Cook and Jameson.
Leader, Jameson, leader. So my big issue is about leadership, because leadership you need it most when you face adversity, which will be on the road. They're going to do that early. And when, you lose a game or during a game you're going to be down, things like that. So I'm worried about the leadership.
My thing there, Rod, guys have to find out how they can lead. Find your own way, because not everybody can lead like Roshan did. Jalen Ford doesn't need to lead like DeMarvion Overshown did. Jalen Ford needs to lead how Jalen Ford is comfortable leading.
Agreed.
Yep, and those interior D linemen, it's the same thing. Mm-hmm. They have to lead how they are comfortable leading.
Yep. For us fans, it's going to be really tough in that regard, because that's the one thing you don't know. Like, we don't see. Now, inside the building, they see, they can know. But from the outside looking in, we just don't get to peer in and see those things. You don't even notice those things necessarily in practice. So that's something that you sort of immediately, like in the first couple weeks of camp, first couple games, can see if they have that leadership or if there are things that are sort of wandering, you start to wonder.
And now we're coming full circle to Quinn. Remember, that was his part of his issue was – he was not ready to be a vocal leader yet. That's why they needed Rojo, a former quarterback in a natural leadership position like quarterback. You cannot avoid leadership. So a big part of his development now is, hey, man, everybody is – they are looking at you. I know JT Sanders is trying to step up. Kelvin Banks is a natural leader. He should be because he leads by example. He's one of the best players in the country. And Xavier Worthy, he needs to be a leader. And you got Jay Witt. Shout out Jay Witt. Sorry about that. Jay Witt's a great leader on offense. But quarterback position, natural leadership position, it's got to be you, dog. And you got to have that, dog.
Sort of like the same conversations people had about Bijan. You knew that, like, he's the best player, but a lot of people were like, is he the leader type? And he's the type that led by example, you know?
Yep. That's an underrated thing, too, about the defensive drop-offs we've seen in the last 10-plus years at Texas where you know, that third year it seems like everything falls off a cliff. You've had some pretty big leadership changes to go through. Like, thinking about going through 11 to 12, the personalities you lost, I mean, Keyston Randall, Manny Acho, Keenan Robinson, Blake Gideon.
Yeah.
You lost some big personalities. And then going from 14 to 15, Quandre and Cedric Reed and Steve Edmond, guys that have been there, for a long time.
Each coach can change.
And then, you know, when from 18 to the next year, you lost Aminahou and Chris Boyd and Chris Nelson. All of those guys were gone.
Yeah. No, it is.
And go listen to those interior D linemen. I mean, all the way up to, you know, Coburn, those guys still talk about what a great leader Chris Nelson was.
Exactly.
And how he set the tone.
Yeah. Totally agree with that. And we don't really know. In retrospect, we hear those stories. But, man, it's not always the best player that necessarily are the best leaders. Mm-hmm. They just are guys who lead by examples. And, like I said, I took it seriously when it was my turn to be a leader. Like, I was ready for that moment. I was like, all right, when Quentin Jammer's gone, that's my secondary. My secondary will perform a certain way. There will be a certain standard we play to. It will be one of the best secondaries in the country. There's no question. It's my secondary, my stamp on it, and it was. And then when it was Nasty Nate, it's like Nasty Nate. Your secondary is like, I already know the deal. I already know the deal, man. Won't be no drop-off here. It's DBU, and that's how you kind of establish it. There will be a drop-off. Of course there was. we won't start talking about that at the end of the show. But, that's how it was established, though, and it was handed down to me when Quentin Jammer helped, you know, and Ahmad Brooks helped bring back DBU. Joe Walker and that crew. Greg Brown.
I know you bring him up every now and then. Joe Walker's a name I don't ever think about until you bring him up.
I love
this
me
podcast.
Some Joe Walker, man. Joe Walker let me stay at his place while I was getting before my freshman year here, and I wanted to come down to summer condition, stay with Joe Walker. Greg Brown, it's awesome. I saw Wade stuff that I shouldn't have seen. It was awesome. Amazing.
The beginning of college.
My mom was like, you might as well go early. I was like, you damn right, I might as well go early. And then Joe Walker let me stay with him. And, oh, man. It was awesome. I was like, and it wasn't real life, though, because we were just working out every day and coming back home to chill.
Yeah.
So it wasn't real life, but it was awesome.
That's more work than most college
kids.
It's kind of like
the bowl game experience you talk about. That's not real football.
Yeah, it wasn't real football. Yeah, I had to go to class and all that once everything got going, so it was tougher. But man,
that's like what the baseball team over Texas is dealing with right now. Like, semester's over, it's all about per diem and going to work out. That's it.
That's it. Oh, that's
get my meal money and work out. That's all you got
to
worry about.
Being a pro.
Yeah. Really is.
Working out, going to the crib. That was awesome.
And I imagine a place like Texas, like for the baseball team, they're like, oh, man, I don't have to go to worry about class right now.
What? Man, what? Go kick it?
Just baseball? Yeah. And you're going to give me some per diem money on top of that? Nice.
Baseball is – did you see that story in the Austin Business Journal about Texas NIL and where baseball ranks? It wasn't specifically talking about baseball.
No.
Oh, man. Baseball is like 10th in all the sports based on their research.
Based on what I've heard from the head coach over there, it's not exactly robust.
It's like, that's got issues, man.
Yeah,
TexasOneFund.org. Hit them up, man.
They hit you up for money yet, Rod?
No.
As an alum?
No, they don't need my money. Well, football doesn't need my money. I guess baseball might need
When are y'all going to start the DBU fund, the DBU endowed scholarship?
Yeah, you know what? No, what I do want, though, is a DBU NIL package. And I don't know if somebody need to get it done. If not, I will have to try to arrange it. And it's pretty easy. I mean, you can go Austin, Bergstrom Airport, no fly zone. You can do a lot of different stuff. All right.
You need what you need to do is you need to call your boy Kenny Vaccaro. Kenny's got that kind of money.
Kenny does. I hung out with Kenny a little bit over at the Collective a couple of times, and Kenny's got so many hustles. He's in the gaming world. He's got shoes. He's like he's hard to keep up with. So every time I hit up Kenny, like it's like I don't know. Like he basically makes me feel overwhelmed because he's got so much stuff going on.
You know what though? Seriously, if you want to do that, and I'll go ahead and throw this out there because I know one of these two guys listens to this show every now and then. Hit up Jam and Quandre if you got that DBU. NIL
Quandre is pretty devoted. Jam is OG DBU, but Quandre is pretty devoted to DBU.
Yeah,
he's like one of the guys that gets people together and stuff like that.
Because he saw you guys do it.
Yeah, and he's one of them personalities, and I keep in touch with Coach Aquino, but I think he talks to Coach Aquino like a lot. So anybody,
love me some Quandre dudes.
Yeah, so if anybody can get it done, and we can get like a DBU kind of a deal, NIL deal, like the Pancake Factory. He could do
well,
it.
Well, even, you know, the Surly Horns folks, they got the burn ends deal for
the
tight ends.
Yeah, DBU needs one, man. Come on now. All right.
Quandre, hit Rod up. Y'all talk it out. Hash it out.
Get Kenny Vaccaro involved. Huff Daddy.
Things.
Yeah. All y'all got money. Let's go.
Yeah, you get some of that Huff money. Huff's got that first round. Huff has the first round pre-rookie salary cap money.
Yeah, top 10 money.
Yeah, no, Huff got, because Huff, I believe, did he own like an IHOP one time? IHOP?
I think he had a couple of them.
I swear he like bought some IHOP just for the hell of, because I swear to God, his quote was like he liked eating there. No, I swear. Back then, I was like, that's how you know you bought it. I was like, why you bought IHOP?
Got me a franchise.
Like these days, it'd probably be a Waffle House. But
that's awesome.
No, I swear he used to own IHOP.
I think Huff and my mom are the only two people I know of that love IHOP that much.
Yeah, I swear there was a story back in the day. I was like, man.
Oh, no, I remember it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm saying, other than Huff and my mom are like the two people keeping IHOP in business.
You know, I got a confession to make. I've never been to a Waffle House. That's strange?
Rod.
Never in my life.
Right.
I think I've only been really one go. Time. I've been one time where I was out of town. I don't know. They aren't around Austin much. I don't know.
There's one out by the airport. I think Kyle Buda area is fixing to get a Waffle House.
What I see now, I don't know if I need to ever go to a Waffle
House. I'm telling you, man.
I don't need to go there.
You talk about getting
antics and hijinks happening. Yeah.
No, that's overrated.
In Oak Hill, where I grew up, there was a gym, so I didn't need to go to an IHOP.
Yeah, maybe that's because we've had better quality places to go for breakfast than Waffle House.
Very
but
true.
In Greenville, North Carolina, after the Super Regional at 2 o'clock in the morning, nothing else in Greenville, North Carolina is open except Waffle House.
I don't discriminate. I would do that in a second.
But I would never end up in Greenville.
Well, that's true.
I arranged my life where I never have to go to Greenville.
I would never end up in
places
like
that.
That's
a good point.
Jerky chicken place in Oklahoma or whatever.
I never end up in Mississippi randomly. So
Rod, have you ever told
I might now with SEC stuff.
Have you told the story about the quota when we went to Okarchi to eat at Ishan's? Craig has told on you for telling the quota story.
About the brother?
Yeah.
It was real.
Yeah.
One black man, and they went to Okarchi, Oklahoma, to Ishan's Fried Chicken Bar, and all they have on the menu is fried chicken, I think Frito pie and hot dogs, if I'm not mistaken, like three items.
Damn, the chicken was good.
Oh, it was good. They'd bring it out to you hot in like a tin can, pretty much, like a little tin bucket, if you will. And we walked in, initially there was one brother at the bar. It was pretty packed in there.
It was a Friday night, so yeah.
But it was no black people, except for this one black man. And I swear to God, no joke. And Jeff saw it. Craig saw it. Everybody saw it.
Roger Wallace
was there. We walk in. The brother looks at me, gives me the black man head nod, and then puts his beer down and walks out.
Yep.
And I'm like, what the hell? I was like, that's weird. And I thought about it for a while. And I was like, bro, I think they got a quota in this joint, man. Because I didn't see any other black people in that joint.
There's only enough room
for like,
one of
you. We will allow one of you to enjoy our delicious fried chicken. And after that, we don't want you telling the others. And it ends up being overrun by the blacks. So you get a quota.
I remember.
Like, you know what? And I was like, that chicken was so damn good, I will observe the quota. If my brother walks in, I'd be like, hey, come in. You take my seat, dog. The chicken
your turn.
It's real good. You need to take the chicken.
I remember you telling that story. Oh, it's true. I made a radio.
Thought I liked chicken because it was
right
delicious.
It was so good. It had no seasoning, really. It was just fresh chicken,
so
like
good.
Mouth water. Oh, it would like when you bite into it, juices would like squirt out.
If you could take like the crust, like the skin from Frenchie's chicken with this meat and somehow mash them together.
Injected it with some juicy
That'd be orgasmic. That'd be, as Brett Bielema once said. Like it, yeah. Borderline orgasmic.
It would be borderline. Well, I don't know. Some of us might go over the edge. Yeah. All right. That's enough from us. We're going
to
wrap it up.
I just took it to the next level.
Matt, I think that makes you
I think he said erotic.
I said erotic blitzes.
So I apologize, Brett Bielema.
It's Rod, I wouldn't call you a habitual line stepper, but you're getting close.
Rest in peace,
Charlie Murphy.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the 7-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for the Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Matt, thanks for everything, man.
You're more than welcome.
Rod, we appreciate the time and the knowledge.
Anytime, brother. Anytime.
For Matt, for Rod, for everybody at the Austin Radio Network and the Horn, 104.9, 101.9 AM, 1260, streaming on the Horn app and at hornfm.com. You get Rod B each and every weekday on Ball Don't Lie from 3 to 7 with Mike Hartz.
Shameless plug.
Get myself and Craig Way on Light the Tower from 10 to noon. And thanks to Matt. Get our archives, our classic interviews and shows. You can get those on the Longhorn Blitz SoundCloud page.
Yep, just type in Longhorn Blitz.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Search Horns 24/7 anywhere you get your podcasts. That's Horns 24/7. No dashes, slashes, or spaces. Click that follow button. Get every episode of The Blitz whenever it drops. And don't forget to leave us a 5-star review. For the Horn family, for the Horns 24/7 family, I'm Jeff Howe. Thank you so much for downloading and listening. And we will catch you again on the next episode.
You've been listening to Longhorn Blitz with Horns247.com. Remember, for the latest Longhorn news 24/7, visit Horns247.com.
Hello, everyone. It's Michael Richards here. You might have seen me on CBS working on their Champions League coverage over the last couple of years. I wanted to tell you about an exciting new podcast that I've been working on. It's called The Rest Is Football. It's me, alongside Gary Lineker and Alan Shearer, two absolute legends of the game. The show combines topical debate from the world of soccer along with outrageous tales from our careers. And I mean outrageous. Just search The Rest Is Football wherever you get your podcasts. All the best from Big Meats.